My first request would be to be allowed to go back to the issue around the structure, because I think that in answering, the Minister has covered most of the questions. But I think it's the issue around the budget and the structure that perhaps is the issue that remains for us to clarify. And then perhaps some of the issues around the indicators as we go forward. Chairperson, I think let me clarify very clearly for the committee. There is a transitional structure that has been approved in the department, and it has been funded across the MTEF to the value of 166 posts for the 3 years. Our evaluation, though, is that we need to ensure that we move more carefully, more cautiously as we go forward, because of the planning process that we've been involved in over this last quarter. And that is the basis in which we have set the targets of 146, 155, and moving to the outer year of 166. We are currently in the process of finalising our operational plans, our spending plan, which is the costing of those operational plans, and the process of identifying exactly which of the posts are being funded and dealing with the JE processes of those posts. As we do that, we will then be able to move to ensuring that we fill those posts. So I wanted that to be clear to the portfolio committee, and we will certainly come back to you by the end of May with a very clear statement of how we are moving forward on that basis. The planning process that we had been through in December and through until we tabled the APP had given us quite a clear understanding that we needed to review the capacity that we would need to be able to deliver. So some of the decisions around which posts to fund that have resulted in that 166 may be issues that we need to be able to refine. And that is current processes that we are involved in, and we are not yet at a point to be able to say it's exactly these posts that would be taken forward. Our concern is the JE process, the job description definition, the JE process, then the advertising needs to be taken on board in order to be able to fill those posts. So I hope that will give you a sense of the way forward. Of 166, it may be useful for the portfolio committee from the E&E to get a sense of how those are located across the budget programs. In Program 1, which is your administration program, of that 166 that had been funded, there are 77 in Program 1. There are 24 in Program 2. So that's your economic policy development branch has a funded capacity of 24 of 166. The planning, economic planning and coordination branch has funded a capacity of 49, and in the budget program 4, which is the social dialogue branch, there are funded posts of 16. So that is the way in which the 166 had taken place, but we are currently in a process of being able to ensure that we identify of those which are the 146 that we need to ensure we fill in this process. So I do want the portfolio committee to understand that is a process that we are currently involved in. We will make it a very visible and transparent process with both the portfolio committee and obviously with Treasury. I hope that will give some clarity as to how we want to be able to proceed moving forward. That obviously does feed also into the question of then the retention strategy and the need for us to be able to ensure that we get the necessary specialists in. And I have indicated that we are in the process of appointing a headhunting company that will enable us to identify the real specialist set of skills that we need in the department. What is also important is, as the Minister has indicated and as is written into the APP, there is work in the department that is not necessarily a full-time and permanent post, or where we need an expert for a particular project for a six-month process. So there will be a process of employment of personnel on that basis as well. Okay, that I think should I hope clarify the process around the HR process, and we will come back to you by the end of May with a very clear statement of where we are with that. It obviously feeds into the MTEF processes in June, July, and obviously into our strategic planning processes for the next five-year cycle.
Thank you very much, teacher. I think it sort of explains, and remember we requested for your the interim, or what you call the transitional structure, and that really is clearly, you know, tabulated fine in terms of the 166 that you're talking about, which to me is your ideal structure for the department. Hence you're saying you are reviewing it, you come back in May, but you say by the end of May with the new revised or the full-fledged, full-approved structure now.
Can I just clarify that? We will come back by the end of May with clarity as to those 146 posts. What are the 146 posts for this financial year? The restructuring process, or the ideal structuring process, will feed into the MT processes. So I'm not, it's 5 weeks is too short to be able to do a complete restructuring. But against the transitional structure, the identification of those 146 posts that will be filled in this year, that is what we will be able to come back with.
So how long will it take you to finalize the organogram for the year?
For this year, by the end of May.
That's the one that's going to be PSA, Public Services and Administration approved.
We already
either
have...
Either approve the PSA approved, or the other way around, PSA and the Minister. PSA, Treasury and the Minister. Is that the one that's... Why I say fully fleshed organogram is because it will be signed that this is what is going to be directing us for the financial.
That's correct.
That's what you're saying. And then the ideal structure is the one that you come back to us as to when are you going to be able to finalize.
That's correct.
I wanted that to be clear so that everybody is clear here. Welcome, Minister. We just started. Yeah, I think that is quite clear, and we appreciate you for that because it was confusing, 166, 146. Now that is clarified, I think we're okay. But DG would also appreciate that while we are working on a new one, new move, the plans in terms of the... You were able to tell us the program, give us figures of the program. Yes. It will also be important that out of that figure of 77 for program one, how is that 77, you know, structured, for instance? Would one, because that's the current plan, isn't it? That you're saying you're busy reviewing. But there is a current plan at the moment that you are improving. It will be important that perhaps one or the other we are also given light to that. Okay. I think that then concludes the issue on the HR. Are there further questions? Methodist?
Chair, just to gain my understanding, is this saying there's going to be an attempt by the department, and if you don't succeed, you go for the headhunting consultants or something companies. All of that will be completed in by end of May. I don't think
No, I think the DG is trying to clarify the issue of 146 without the 136. Remember that in terms of the E&E, there is 166 posts for the financial, for the MPF. So they are saying for this financial year, they cannot afford, for instance, to employ 166. Hence, they gave themselves a target of 146. But that doesn't talk to the plan that they have currently. So hence, she's saying that they are busy reviewing that, and they're going to be giving us at the end of May that the fully revised plan. Are you here now? Okay. Thank you. Any other? I think we are all satisfied. DG, Minister, if you, we were dealing with the questions, they were sending questions. I don't know if we should allow them the DG to continue, and then you'll come after. Okay.
Chairperson, the one other issue that I wanted to pick up on was the issue of the CIFA provincial level of posts. I don't have the detailed knowledge of the vacancy level at provincial level in CIFA. So I think that what we would need to ensure is that we raise this question with CIFA, who are presenting to the Portfolio Committee tomorrow, so that in that presentation they would be able to clarify on those issues. So I think that would deal with the vacancy level at national level, provincial level, as well as the coordination between those aspects. In relation to the concern that you had raised around the emails of the staff at CIFA and the union communication, my understanding is that that was a technical problem that was very quickly resolved. That is the information that came to my attention at the stage at which it was brought to my attention. I have already this morning asked for people to go and verify that, and I will provide further communication to the Portfolio Committee if the information that I have is in any way incorrect or if there is any further clarity that we can get on that issue. We are very comfortable as a department that any issues that anybody is concerned about should be raised with the Portfolio Committee. That oversight enables us to be able to better address issues as they go forward. So from our perspective, we appreciate the Portfolio Committee receiving issues raised with them and being able to convey them through to us in that regard. I'm just scrolling through to see the others that we would need to deal with. On the issue of the impact, we are comfortable that the management performance assessment tool and the evaluation that is done by the department first of all and then moderated through DBME is an extremely useful tool for improving the management of departments. As a new department, to use the minister's phrasing, under 4 years old, we were comfortable when we did the assessment towards the end of last year that there was significant progress that had been made, but in the process it also identifies quite quickly areas in which improvements need to be made. As a result of that, and with the moderation, we've already begun to put in place a number of initiatives that will address some of the weaknesses that were identified in that process. And we are developing action plans for each of the four areas that will improve the governance of the department as we go forward. So we are confident as management, partly because we are using the management meetings to monitor those processes, that when we do the impact assessment in October of this year, we will be in a significantly better process than we have been. Already, as we closed the financial year, we were quite comfortable that there were things in place by the end of the financial year that had been identified in the impact in October as areas that we needed to improve. I'm not sure which other questions are outstanding that I should focus on. I think perhaps just to indicate that we are in the process of finalising the details of the operational plan that takes each of the key performance indicators and the targets and breaks them down into monthly work as we go forward, and we are developing a spending plan that speaks to that, so that during the course of the year we will be able to monitor those and that will feed into the quarterly reports that would then come through to the Portfolio Committee on a quarterly basis. I think the point about the summary of the technical indicator descriptors is a very useful one for AEP processes going forward, and we will certainly strive to include a summary of that into the APP and strategic plan for the next cycle going forward. Perhaps, Jefferson, if there are issues that I should have addressed that I've skipped, you could indicate any outstanding issues.
Thanks, DJ. I don't see any hands. It shows that you have satisfactorily answered the technical issues. Minister, I don't know if there were outstanding issues, but I remember the one on the Enterprise Development Institute. You did last time, I think, when we were addressing the second quarter report, you did allude to the fact that you currently have economic development virtual institute like that. But in as far as the enterprise development institute, not entrepreneurs, not enterprise, entrepreneur development institute, like Mr. Ndudu was asking. I think he also made mention of an example of a school in the KZN and Cape Town. I think those are the only two provinces that have such a Michael House. He was asking along that way in relation to the party resolution. I know the minister tried to respond to and to that. But I don't know whether you'd want to come back to that to clarify further in as far as we understand it. Because Minister, I also have a challenge here, because we had thought that you'd be coming up with something like, if you remember well, in one, after the one of the public hearings that we had, in Parliament on SMEs, access to finance by SMEs. An issue, you know, emerged there where they requested that it would be perhaps important that we create some kind of they called it a conference, or they called it entrepreneurial conference, something like that, wherein you went to take to bring the like minds together on an annual basis, where they're going to be sharing skills or sharing experiences, sharing the work that they, you know, areas of their work that they have commonalities around. And I thought the department had really accepted that. This is in relation to what you responded to. But I thought it's going to happen in a structured manner, but it doesn't come out, you know, in the documents. It's something that's, you know, continually being planned on, unless we are missing a point somewhere. I know that something related to the work that is being done between the department and the University of Johannesburg, but I'm not sure whether it's related to that. There's something being done between the department and Vet University. I'm not sure whether that is related to that. If perhaps the minister can take us through that so that we refresh our minds on that. Yeah, that's in addition to the issues that questions that you have that are outstanding.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me start by indicating that the questions earlier that I think were not responded to, I have only one, which is the question of international agreements that I enter into, and that the PC would like an opportunity to be briefed on that.
I think there's something. Is it the phone, or is it something that you should be concerned about? As long as it doesn't have to do with any threat or fire from it. Yes. Unfortunately, the committee assistants and the secretaries are not here, both of them. I don't know, where are they? Give me a minute, I think they will check.
So we'd have to brief the portfolio committee if the committee indicates which international agreements it's referring to. We did one quite interesting agreement last year, which was the one with China Development Bank, which in fact we signed in the presence of members of the committee during the budget vote day in the session just preceding the budget vote. So that is the one that the committee would like to be briefed on, or if there are any others. I'm happy to go back to the question raised by Honorable Ntuli on entrepreneurs. As I said, let's separate out the the political party position, which I think is a question of a policy institute, from an entrepreneurship development. At the moment, what is the department doing? And it's we want to use the budget vote period to indicate, obviously, it's a relationship between the APP and the budget itself. But the budget vote is where we can highlight some of the areas that we've identified with the portfolio committee. They have some things to say in the budget vote. So some of the areas, I think, Chair, that you're alluding to, it's our hope that in the budget speech we could talk more in detail on some of them. But I think the committee is aware from our briefings probably last year that we entered into a partnership with SAICA. And that partnership was intended to help promote finance skills so that as we, what does EDD do on small business? It is the structure that CFA is accountable to. So we don't micromanage CFA, but at the same time, we do give them their strategic framework. CEDA reports to DTI. EDD hooks up CIFA and CEDA, and that's a big part of our small business development program. And I've spoken at the last session that I addressed the committee in considerable detail on that. What the SAICA program does is it goes beyond funding, because when you provide a loan to a small business, there's still the question whether that small business has the technical skill to become profitable. And some, but not all of that, relates to financial skills. Small businesses, big challenge, we often as committee members have found in your visits in the provinces, some of the big challenges lies in paying for these skills. A large company can bring in a chartered accountant, a small company can't always afford it. And so helping to increase the skills pool helps, but also placing young people with smaller businesses. So the SAICA program was launched last year, and the first phase of that program is now completed. We want to do SAICA Mark II, meaning a second version of it, in the current financial year, utilizing some of the savings that the department has been able to generate and building on the successes of the previous program. So I had intended, I mean, I don't see any media yet, but I intended really to use the budget foot to try to connect the SAICA program and the rest of the small business program a little bit more coherently. I think my earlier answer is also relevant. That there's some things that we're doing with FET colleges that may be relevant to Honorable Mpuli's question. It may not cover Midlands College, but some of the other colleges where our attempt is to try to provide practical support between the IDC and those colleges. Increasingly, the IDC's role is becoming more than just a financier of business. It's also beginning to address the problems in the community, in the society. And as I've indicated now, there are 8 FET colleges that the IDC is supporting, as well as, incidentally, it's not relevant to the current question, but a number of schools that the IDC has adopted now. So that we really use our public institutions to fix the system as a whole. The department doesn't have a plan to set up an entrepreneurship institute, but there are many entrepreneurship programs at the universities that would fall under the funding and budget of higher education and training. There's scope for us to work more and better with the universities to open their entrepreneurship programs to smaller businesses. And that may be a good initiative to launch. I'm trying to recall, Jefferson, the specific issue that you've drawn our attention to, and I think is a knowledge network on entrepreneurship that we were speaking of, which is to bring together the experience on an ongoing basis, not one meeting, but right through the year, to connect the people with knowledge and experience in small business with each other and with the knowledge that we've got in government and in the private sector in the larger companies. Committee members will see the knowledge network KPI in the performance plan, and one of those will clearly deal with questions of entrepreneurship, and it will bring the entrepreneurs together, as I have indicated in the last meeting at the portfolio committee. So that's on the entrepreneurship issue. I think we've covered the other questions, but if between DJ and myself, I was not present for some of DJ's comments, so I'm assuming all the technical questions have been answered. If there's any other, please feel free to draw my attention to it and I'll comment on it. But I think that covers the issues we raised with us.
Actually, you came in, Minister, at the right time when the DJ just you haven't missed much because we had just started. Thank you very much for the responses, and maybe it will be it will serve the committee and the public better if you give us, for some of the things we are doing, we don't have, you know, you don't sort of claim ownership on very good work that has been done, but not people not aware of what this department is doing, especially in support of small medium enterprises. It will be important that perhaps either that comes out of your annual report and as some of the achievements that you've made. But I would also want to know as to how far did Cycle 1 go, so that we, in terms of how many entrepreneurs or whether there are people who are already in business or people who are still wanting to be in business, that you've covered per province, also the gender profiling, and don't forget also if you could include the disabled people on that. I think that would help us a lot, so that we are able to also share the information, so that as we go to Cycle 2, we build on a strain on the surfaces of Cycle 1. Members, I don't know if you still have other questions to the department on other issues. We haven't touched on international issues as yet, the work of BRICS. The minister tried to say something on BRICS. We haven't gone that far, but we all know that there was a successful BRICS summit in Durban. If there are any further questions related to that, it's important, and it's an opportune time for members to get that information. Otherwise, if you don't have, there's nothing wrong in saying I'm okay, so that we can proceed with the meeting. Message, you all right? Mr. Co-ops, don't worry, let me go and leave over now. Oh, yes, as we were taught, co-ops and SMEs. Otherwise, we run the danger of being criticized by Bob Mabas. Thank you very much. Bob Mabas, I might not have a question. He's been in the DCI, or why is the department now? Trade and Industry Portfolio Committee. I hope you don't have any questions. Don't say we did not give you an opportunity. Huh? Oh, okay. That's your loss, it's not ours. Thank you very much, Minister. Thank you very much, DG, and the rest of the delegation from the department. We hope our engagement was more was successful in opening up some of the areas that you felt that you didn't know you needed to focus on. And I'm sure talking on behalf of the members that we also have gained some valuable information from the department. We'll continue to work together in making sure that the people get what we promise them to get through the Department of Community Development. Thank you very much. The first part of our meeting then is then concluded. May we then move to the second part of our meeting, which is on PICC. As discussed in our previous meetings, Minister, I think we agreed that we're going to be requesting you to brief us on the work that you are coordinating at the secretarial level on PICC. That is the Presidential Infrastructure Coordination the Council or Commission? Is it a Council or Commission? Commission. I think today we are in a space where you can be able to really inform us on the work that you are doing. You will have at least 2 hours or so to engage with us on this topic. Tomorrow, of course, we'll be having expert presentations from people who are dealing directly with these issues. And at least we'll gain the further insight into what exactly they plan going forward, especially in relation to the time frames and so forth. Be able to know when are they starting or whether they have started, when are they completing and so forth. Otherwise, let me hand over to you, Minister, for the presentation. I don't know whether I'm seated in the right place. Are we? Wouldn't you want to come here?
Sure, no, I think we find the side if...
I don't want it to be like you are the department again. You were the department then, we were interrogating you, now we are in a learning environment and would want to mix with you so that there's no us and you. We want you to feel free to be in that mode now that you are giving us information.
Okay, all right, maybe let's pick up your offer and then we'll cross floor. I thought
from the chair, you know, that position of the chair, because it's quite intimidating to be always, and I want to hand it over to you so that you can be in control. Give us as much as you can, as much information as you can, please. Did you maybe want to join the minister here?
Thank you very much. Chairperson, I would have strongly advised you not to put me in the chair. I now have authority and power over this committee.
Okay.
I am hoping that the Honourable Mubu would put up his hand so I may rule him out of order. I am doing what presiding officers ever do, which is to make light-hearted comments. Thank you very much, Chair, for this opportunity. I really appreciate also that the committee has gone into workshop mode. So in that context, I want to first be guided by honorable members. We've got a presentation. It's about 50 slides or so. We could easily take the entire 2 hours running through what is the infrastructure program, where is the build program taking place, what is the role of EDD, what are we doing on skills, or you could guide us what you would be particularly keen for us to focus on in the time. So it can be a bit of an interactive session. The presentations we do at Cabinet are formidable. I mean, they often are 150 slides packed with information. So it's really trying to select the areas that would be of most help to the committee. The presentation that we have prepared and that we've handed out is an attempt at a very high-level summary, really at a high level of aggregates. So it doesn't go into what we're doing in the Durban Digout Port, or how far we were the Sinter plant in the Northern Cape, or what is the challenges of the program around improving iron ore from Sishen to Saldanha, which is really the day-to-day work of the department. So if I may ask, now that I've got the opportunity to sit here, if committee members could just indicate what would be most helpful from us. We're ready with the presentation, so that we can do. But because we're in workshop mode, instead of subjecting you to another lengthy presentation, if you'd like us to run through it, we're very happy to do so. If you'd like just to really have a conversation, a Q&A, in which you ask us some issues, that would also be fine. So if I could really be asked to be guided on what would be most helpful now that we're in workshop mode, not in the interrogation mode that we've just come out of. And the offer is there's a presentation that we can take you through if that helps. Or we can have a Q&A session, or we can just talk about EDD, what EDD does on a daily basis on infrastructure. Honourable, will we have the floor?
Thank you, Honourable Minister. I think we have listened to you and your team over the past hours in a presentation mode, which I think can be a little bit daunting, and especially after lunch. But if we went into that, I think it would be, to not be advisable. I would suggest that we go into a Q&A session. I know that because we have seen, I think all of us have seen this presentation, the detail of this presentation, we know what it is. But I think some of us will have questions as to just what's happening since the announcement of the program, because I don't know about my colleagues, but what I feel myself is that there's not much information coming out to inform not only us but the public in general to what extent the implementation is going. Because in the morning we talked about the issue of job creation. There was a reference to the fact that certain number of jobs were lost and certain number of jobs were created. We don't know whether these were lost or created as a result of this, the infrastructure development program, or it was something else. So I personally feel that I think we should engage on a question and other approach so that we don't get too bored.
Thank you. Chairperson, I saw your hand next, and then Honourable Ntuli. I think the Chair is referring to the Honourable Ntuli. You have the floor.
Yeah, thanks. I think I will go with your last comment when you were saying that maybe you can take us around what the EBD is doing in the infrastructure development, particularly as you are coordinating. But if we can get exact the department, how is it involved as an EDD? Secondly, maybe you can also touch on the infrastructure development bill of how are we going to approach it. I mean, maybe if that also can be included. Thanks.
Honourable Mbasa, you have the floor.
Thanks, Colonista, Chairperson, and members of the committee and department and visitors. My apology once more for coming late. We started in another meeting in the morning. In addition to what the two colleagues have asked for, I will ask for an area that empowers small businesses and cooperatives, because often when huge projects get undertaken, it is often assumed that this is so huge, the only people that can provide it properly on time and qualitatively and quantitatively are the long established business people. So that has one disadvantage. It empowers, actually not empowering, it enriches those that have already been extremely rich, which is one day. And then when we say how do a small SMMEs and cooperatives come in, it is the very big businesses that say they should come in this manner. And that manner is where they super exploit these SMMEs and cooperatives. So I'm focusing more on that, if that could be spoken to. Thanks, Colleague Chair.
Okay, I wonder if maybe we can give Honourable Tsetse the floor, and then I think thereafter maybe we just begin to have an interaction, because I think the Chair is really keen that we get to workshop mode as opposed to presentation mode. So then we can take another round after Honourable Tsetse has had an opportunity.
Thank you, Minister. I am actually
asking
my question being considered of the fact that KCC is a fairly new program, that as of July 2011, when it was constituted, is there anything of progress that you can say regarding FDI within the context of KCC? And I'm aware that it's fairly new. You may not expect as much, but I think there's something that you can say regarding progress or something that has been done.
No, thank you very much. I think let me start with the infrastructure program itself. Just a few comments on it that will situate some of the issues. The country has run infrastructure programs for a very long time. If you think about it, the very first time a colony was set up in 1652, it was really a small infrastructure program in the wider trade between Europe and Asia. And so they set up a water refreshment station for their ships, and they set up a little military fort in Cape Town where they could make sure that those neighbors who are not going to accept their rule so easily are dealt with. But seriously, infrastructure is part of any country's development. We had infrastructure before 1652. We had infrastructure development after. So what's new? What's new is that government is now working on an integrated program connecting different parts. And the best illustration I can give is by taking the questions that Honorable Mubo asked on jobs. At the moment, Honorable Mubu, the PICC manages 18 major projects. And I say manages, it doesn't go out there and do the actual construction. It coordinates the activities. That's more than 110 individual construction projects involved. They range from very large, like Medupi, which when it's completed will be something of the order of 100 billion or more, to a small project, which is to build 50 schools in the Eastern Cape, which by the standards of Middle P would be much smaller. 150,000 jobs are currently sustained in just those projects that the PICC coordinates. And of them, the single biggest one by far is the energy programs, because we're in a big, bold program. So you've heard the figures on Medupi, but Kusile is the other big one. Kusile has got about 11,000 workers. Now, you know, someone asked me the other day, they said in 2010, the infrastructure program was much bigger. And I said, no, our one currently is actually bigger. The difference was, in 2010, it was near all the main airports. So people like ourselves who travel a lot could see airport bold and stadia and so on. But if you go to Kusile, in the you get 11,000. You go to Medupi in Limpopo, you get close to 16,000 people. If you go to Ingula, which is on the border of KZN and Free State, you get about 3,000 people. These are major programs. So that's the one big thing that we're doing. So a lot of the new jobs are coming through the infrastructure program. Some of the jobs are in industrially intensive areas. It's not only building infrastructure. In the Northern Cape, I don't know if any of the honorable members are from the Northern Cape, but we're working now to unlock the manganese wealth. And so what we've done is we are supporting the construction of infrastructure around a major manganese mine sinter plant. The construction is now underway. We hope by June, July, the sinter plant will be completed. Once it's done, we then simultaneously are working on strengthening the infrastructure to move the manganese sinter from Northern Cape to Eastern Cape. Some of it will be exported through the port of Mocha, so we've got to try to ensure that the infrastructure in Mocha is appropriate. Some of it will be processed locally, beneficiated in the Mocha area, which is next to the port, in a manganese smelter plant. Now, all of that would be what we call industrial infrastructure. So if you add all of that up, the multiplier impact of the infrastructure program is the thing that is helping jobs in South Africa. Without that, we would have been in real difficulty because of the weakening of our global markets. So that's what the program is about. The question then goes to the small business and co-ops. Let me pause. And I'm glad. Let's just have an interactive session. It's helpful.
Thank you, Minister. I'm sorry if I might just interrupt my listening to your answer. I'm expecting a call for a radio interview anytime soon. But I just wanted to say,
thank you. The job interview.
No, the job interview.
No, not that.
Okay. Politics.
Okay.
Your answer and the relationship between the creation of jobs, the infrastructure and the creation of jobs. I think that this is what we are looking at to see happen. During the World Cup, preparations for the World Cup, perhaps 2010, there was massive infrastructure development, the infrastructure of like a stadium and so on and so forth. That was visible to the public. Everybody could see what the government is doing. There were jobs created, but of course they were not sustainable for a longer time, particularly in the construction area, and those are gone. But then we are left with infrastructure that has now become a bit of, for lack of a better term, white elephant, that have now become a bit of a problem in terms of maintaining and sustaining and then so on and so forth. But also one thinks of a project like Caltrain, which over the past few months have been reported to be doing exceedingly well. The expectations are very high. In fact, it exceeded expectations in terms of performance, the use of it, that is really beginning to pay back what it owes. That's a project that that many people are proud of, especially those of us who come from that area of the country. We use it often, come to the airports from here and so on and so forth. It's visible. It brings pride even to the visitors who come to this country. You are proud that you can tell someone arriving from England, jump on the train and pick you up at Hatfield in Victoria. It's things like that are visible, they are tangible, they are, you know. But I understand that the other projects that are talking about, yes, in the long term they want to add on to the job creation, the value of... But my question is still, and my comment is that I think there's not much visibility. Not many people are aware of what the things that you're discussing now are talking about, those projects. They happen like in the background. The only time probably some people hear about Ngobe is when they strike. They don't know what's going on there. Just my views, Chair. Minister, thank you.
I think that actually, absolutely. I mean, just take Kusile as an example. Kusile is in the Nkangala district of Mpumalanga. It's a place that people normally go to. It's a construction site literally outside the main metro areas and the visible areas of the media. So what we're going to be doing this year is we're going to be publicizing more of this. And we set aside some money now in EDD to do that, and the PICC and President will also put some money into this. But I want to go through what is it that the state needs to do. The state's infrastructure program is about creating jobs, but it's also about laying the foundations of long-term growth. Even though Kusile, and I'll use Kusile because we use Medupi all the time, 11,000 people, it's a massive program. Kusile and Medupi, by the way, just those two programs together employ about close to 30,000 people. If you think about it, that's the size of all of Sasol's operations together. Huge. Now, though there is not much visibility, people are employed, and it's fundamental to our long-term growth potential. Security of energy supply is key. So we've got to put money into areas like Kusile and Medupi. EDD's role in that is to ensure that the program, working with our partner departments, meet the targets in terms of deadlines. Many of these big projects have overshot the deadline in the past. Since the PICC time, we're now making up the time. You've seen that Medupi, we've lost some time. It's our intention to make it up. So whatever has been lost through industrial action and contractual disputes this year, our plan now is to make that time up in the next few months. But as we build this, we must avoid white elephants, as you say. I would take a different view. Perhaps stadia are not all white elephants. If the country wants to position itself to be a major venue for sport tourism, then it needs an infrastructure like that. And remember, we've invested a lot in the World Cup to visibly bring South Africa as a name into everybody's mindset across the world. If you travel broadly, you'll find many people who've never heard of South Africa are avid soccer lovers, and they would have heard of the country through 2010. 2 years after 2010, our tourism numbers shoot through the roof. Our tourism growth last year was double the international average. Double what was the global growth of tourism. Part of that reason is the exposure we received in the World Cup. You don't get that exposure unless you have a stadium. So it's easy to get that kind of value when you've got the sports infrastructure in place. And we make our money now not in the stadium, because they don't use it that regularly. We make our money through tourists coming here, going to B&Bs, going to hotels, using our trains and our airplanes, restaurants, and so on. So infrastructure has to have broader vision than just the return to the facility you build. So that's the first part of infrastructure that I'd like to raise. The second one is infrastructure must connect the rural poor to the urban areas. A lot of our bus infrastructure entrench the old spatial patterns of apartheid. The new infrastructure must connect roads in rural areas. And if honorable members have been recently in the Eastern Cape, if you've driven outside of the two metros, I would be quite confident you've seen roadworks. Huge amounts of roadworks on the N2. That's the infrastructure program in what we call the Samba Songe part of it. Gautrain, yes, Gautrain is very successful, but it costs the state a lot of money. Our focus now is not so much on new Gautrains. We're going for the less glamorous, but perhaps even more important, integrated public transport systems. So in Joburg, getting the Rea Vaya right, or the My City in Cape Town, is very important. So what do we do now as PICC? There are six major areas where we look at the Rea Vaya every quarter. And I've got the information here, for example, the information that is tabled directly to Cabinet, that are commercially sensitive information about what is happening in some areas. But within that, we monitor now Rea Vaya, so I would be able to tell you how much growth has been in Rea Vaya program in Joburg, My City in Cape Town. In Nelson Mandela Bay, we've got 15 kilometers of bus lanes. In Etequini, we've got two phases that we're working on that will be completed. The first phase will be completed by 2018. In Rustenburg, we've got a Rustenburg rapid transport system that we're supporting. And finally, in Swane, we have a program worth 3.2 billion rand that is going to be rolled out. So we've shifted from your big high-speed trains to your integrated inner-city transport, connecting taxis, buses, and trains much more seamlessly. So you've seen it for parliamentarians that have used the public transport in Cape Town. You've seen it here, that the plans are now coming together. Joburg is the most advanced. When we complete with this, it will be 12 cities that will be involved, but we're starting with the six that I've named now. So our infrastructure program is shifting qualitatively from the large mega project of Gautrain. That was necessary. It's important linking Joburg and Pretoria as we've done. But in a new phase, it is inner-city transport. Digging up pavements, connecting things more clearly, that is our work. So what does EDD do? Basically every week, one of our staff members is in touch with a metro. Maybe we're in touch with Nelson Mandela Bay. And we get a report on what has happened in the last 3 months with their integrated public transport system. Let's say they advise us that they are ready to go on tender now. They've completed the bus thing, they want to purchase buses. Our job then would be to sit with them and help make sure that the tender conditions specify local buses. Let's say they have a underspending. These are all real examples I'm using. We'd call the mayor and the CFO of the city to a meeting of the PICC. We'll give them an analysis of spending that we have compiled, and we'll ask them whether this is accurate and what is their turnaround plan. We'll then invite them 3 months later to report to us on whether their turnaround plan has been implemented. So that's on the public transport, but a shift in the focus, but also a shift in what it is that a coordinating department does. Let me go then to the question that was asked on small business and co-ops. Some of our programs are focused on small businesses. So in the Eastern Cape, we're busy with the completion of 49 schools, Honorable Mabasa. And about half those contracts went to small companies, where the small companies are the primary contractors. In some cases, a small company take on an entire school that they're going to build. In a program like Medupi, by definition, it's multi-billion rand. It has enormously complex technology. It is massive. It needs 16,000 people. It is something that large companies tender for. And those large companies in turn assemble their subcontractors, which are smaller companies. So for certain projects, they're not capable of being designed to be run by small businesses. and for other projects that can be run by small businesses. So what does EDD do? In the case of the school build program, we've got a list of all 49 schools in the Eastern Cape. Every 2 weeks, we get an update report on how far that is. I think once a month or so, we get a photograph of the school showing the additional amount that has been built in that month. Where there are problems, as there sometimes are, we step in and we try to solve the problem. In one case, the problem was a contractor was not delivering. So what we did was we helped the project manager to put pressure on the contractor to withdraw so that a new contractor can be procured that would ensure that schools are actually built. In another case, the same contractor had too many contracts. They had a contract for an airport as well as for the schools. They were completely overextended, and we helped to ensure that in that case they rationalized. In the third case, which we haven't solved, the Department of Basic Education reported that there's a shortage of building materials in parts of the Eastern Cape, and if the shortage continues, we will need to convene a meeting with building suppliers to rapidly increase their stocks of bricks, cement, wood, and so on in the Eastern Cape. So that's really what we do, is to hear where the problem is and to try to unblock it. The most important first step is information, and it's not as easy to collect information as it is from the outside. So we put a lot of energy into building information systems. We have a team of a couple of people, about 4 or 5 people now, DG, who only collect information. They make phone calls round the clock. I think they log in probably thousands of calls a month, just collecting information on systems and the progress in the different parts of the infrastructure program. Do we promote small businesses? Yes, we do. We do so by ensuring that the large companies subcontract, but we can't run those contracts, and we can't select the small businesses. You've got to leave that to the contractor to do, because remember, somebody must take responsibility for delivering the program on time. If we had to choose which companies ESCOM must use for the power station, and those companies let ESCOM down, then ESCOM would not be able to deliver on the public mandate they've given. So we are very sensitive to small business. We even want to change the tender conditions to require the big contractors to support the small businesses more actively. But the selection of the small businesses is left to the main contractor. So that we put out a contract on tender and they come in. The development finance institutions, Honorable Tretzi, yes. The IDC is now supporting the infrastructure program in a number of different ways. In the Kusile Power Station, ESCOM is the implementation agency. ESCOM puts out a tender. That tender includes all the equipment that needs to be bought. In the past, we imported a lot of the components. The IDC has now partnered with a local company to produce an air-cooled condenser system. And the IDC is providing co-finance to that South African company to be able to pick up that contract and provide the air-cooled condenser system. It's a massive contract. From memory, it's probably about 2.5 billion rand, and it will use an enormous amount of local steel that is produced in South Africa using South African iron ore. So it's part of our beneficiation program. We'll be using local iron and steel, and it will produce a finished product that goes into the Kusile Power Station. So there the IDC, which is the DFI concerned, plays an absolutely key role. The other place where the IDC plays a role is in ensuring that there's enough investment in building materials. So the IDC has a partnership, and by the way, the PIC, not PICC, the PIC, the Public Investment Commission, they both have shareholdings in 2 cement companies. Well, the IC's got a joint venture with the one, and the PIC has got shareholding in it. So there, the two finance institutions help to ensure that there's investment into the material that come into the building program. The IDC has helped the equipment, as I indicated in our earlier session. Bell in turn supplies the yellow metals, the big earth-moving equipment. So if you really look at the IDC's work, it is very actively involved in the infrastructure program. The DBSA is the other DFI that also plays a role in infrastructure. They do so as project managers. They're the project manager at the moment for the school board program for basic education in the Eastern Cape. And they also project manage a number of programs at municipal level. So those are the DFIs that play that role. I thought initially your question was on FDI, which is foreign direct investment, although I was prompted that you're referring to development finance institutions. Because I was going to say that foreign investment is important in an economy, and it has a role in infrastructure. But we are indicating to foreigners that they've got to set up operations in South Africa. And we hope that that is accompanied by local partners so that we build a long-term capacity as a country. 30 years ago, China had very little capacity in nuclear energy. Today, China is a major player in nuclear energy. 40 years ago, Korea had no technology. Today, Korea exports technology on nuclear energy. And so they all have used the infrastructure build program to develop the capacity locally. So I wanted to use a couple of those examples to show how we use the infrastructure program. Can I come back to Honorable Ntuli's question on what is the role of the department? What does EDD do? Now, I've given some indications of it, but I'd like to give a few more examples, but maybe let me pause.
Thanks, Chair. I'm sorry to disturb you. Before I want to ask about the beneficiation. If you can clarify, this little saying that, like iron ore, and then the beneficiations, where they are saying that it is easy to export this iron ore. And then when it's outside, then it's a complete component, then it comes cheaper than when we sell it around in South Africa. And we find that when you compare the prices, when it comes to competition, then you find that the South Africans, they are finding it very difficult to compete with our own iron ore, which we have exported, and when it comes in, it's cheaper. Can you clarify that, whether it is a myth or that?
But I think that's very often true. And the reasons for it are important to indicate. We've got quite large iron ore deposits in the Northern Cape, in and around an area called Sishen. We've got two major steel mills that use South African iron ore and turn it into steel. The one is located in Saldanha, here in the Western Cape, and the other one is in Van der Bell Park. Then we have other foundries that also use these inputs to produce molded products and so on. And then finally, we've got companies that use scrap metal to produce steel that can be used for wires and so on. So that's the landscape. We use about 15% or so of our iron ore locally. So we beneficiate about 15%. We don't sell all of it. But about the other 85%, maybe 80%, is exported. It's exported increasingly to countries like China. China's got a massive industrial economy. Huge steel mills, and those steel mills in turn have got customers in the making of computers, laptops, cars, all sorts of things. So if we were to want to use all of our iron ore, the problem is who would we sell it to? you'll need a steel mill. A steel mill would have to be profitable to be able to compete. And the steel mills that we have, they're holding their own in the market, but they are not as large as the massive Chinese steel mills. So in a case like that, the way in which you work out the price of a unit of steel is look at the economies of scale. If you do a thousand units of something, then each unit is cheaper than if you do 10 units of something. So engineering, manufacturing of something, in working out, I'm trying to find a way of just briefly capturing what the challenge is. Challenge ultimately comes down to the fact that China's scale is so large that they can outcompete the South African steel mill. So China is a bigger market for iron ore. So Australia sells to China, we sell to China, Brazil, a number of different countries sell to China. What is government's program? Our program is we don't want to ban the export of iron ore, but we want more of that iron ore to be used locally. Local mills tell us, okay, we can do so, but we need a price preference. If we pay the same price as China, then there's no incentive to do it locally. So part of our discussions with ArcelorMittal and Kumba was about the price of iron ore to the local industry. So in China, scale is a driver. In South Africa, it's proximity. It's the fact that the iron ore is in this country that can be our driver. And that's the logic of beneficiation. What have we done on beneficiation? On iron ore, as I said, we've got the ArcelorMittal plants. On coal, a very large part of South Africa's coal is used by Eskom and Sasol. So coal is probably the best beneficiated mineral product in South Africa. On manganese, in the past we didn't do much on manganese, but now we're building a sinter plant in the Northern Cape, and we want to support a ferromanganese smelter in the Eastern Cape, so that more of the manganese is something that goes into the making of steel. So certain qualities of steel, you need iron ore and manganese to be able to produce right strength and flexibility. On platinum, some of our platinum is used. Remember, we're the world's biggest known source of platinum. So we now use platinum in catalytic converters, which is the things that you use for exhaust pipes. And about 15% of the global production of catalytic converters take place in South Africa. So there is beneficiation programs. The challenge is to make them larger. But you can't make them larger unless you can produce at a competitive price. If you don't have a competitive price, you can produce all the steel in the world and no one is going to buy it. And that goes to the infrastructure program. So what we're now doing with infrastructure is by building the right rail lines and energy stations and so on, we can help to ensure that we have stability of energy supply, because a steel mill needs that. And with rail lines, we can make it cheaper to move the steel across the country. So that's how the infrastructure program helps. You can't just decree beneficiation. You can't just, as government, announce it. You now need to work on the hard issue. So the IDC is working on the viability of a second steel operation in South Africa. But in developing the business plan, the IDC will need, number one, a private sector partner. So you don't do this with just the IDC skill base. Private sector partner will only come if they can make profit. So we need what is called a commercially viable bankable plan. That means a project proposal that can be financed by a private sector player and the IDC together. In the next couple of months, the IDC will wrap up its work on this. They've looked at a number of different options, and they will have to come up with steel that is competitively priced. So beneficiation remains a big program of government, but it's a tough one to implement. And therefore, we're putting so much emphasis on it right now. Going to the foreign direct investment, as I indicated, we're putting the condition on foreigners to build capacity locally. So if we look at the train purchase program of Transnet and PRASA, EDD's role increasingly must be to ensure that more and more of the trains are made locally and that we find foreign markets to export those trains. Recently, working with the IDC, a private sector player landed a contract in Mozambique for the supply of locomotives and trains made in South Africa. It wasn't a huge order, but it's the first of, we hope, a couple of big orders. So I want to go really to the kind of work EDD does on a day-to-day basis, using the examples that you've given, and I've tried to illustrate with that what the department does. Now, it's a bit of a challenge for the portfolio committee to try to work out the proper oversight role, because our role varies so greatly. What we do on inner-city transport is very different to what we will do in Medupi. Like with Medupi now, part of our job is to try to think through with DPE, how can we create a better labor relations environment so that you don't have a constant set of stoppages over the next 2 to 3 years as Medupi comes to a close. Then once we've got that, what happens when Medupi is finished? So by 2017, 2018, 15,000 people are jobless because the program is finished, the power station is running. So we'll need to do a social plan. So again, EDD will bring together the Department of Labor, the Department of Public Enterprises, ESCOM, DTI and so on, and say, guys, what can we do in Lephalale to absorb 15,000 people who are going to be jobless by the end of this program? Now, if you think about that, that's an enormous number of people. And not all of them can be absorbed in small businesses. Some can. There may be an opportunity in some co-ops. But some of it will be retraining of workers into activities outside of infrastructure. So we then have to talk to DHET. So that's the kind of day-to-day work that we're beginning to do in the infrastructure plan. The first couple of months, we just collected all the information. We now have a dashboard. And the dashboard, and there's an example of the dashboard in this presentation that we've done, although obviously we haven't put the information in here, because the information is cabinet-level information. But that dashboard allows cabinet to see every quarter what is actually happening. And if you go to page 47 of the presentation, it will say to you what is the SIP project, so maybe it's SIP 1. It will give you the project name, and looking at that, that looks like it's a power station being built, so maybe that could very well be Medupi. It will tell you the target, what did we intend to do with Medupi, what is the total cost of Medupi, when did we start with the project. It's an important thing so that we can keep an eye on the development of that particular program, and when is the project complete? So we know, for example, because it's in the public domain, that Medupi will be finished in 2017. And then we look at catalytic effect. What impact does Medupi have right through the country? And what's the current program? Now, there's a unit of Medupi that will have close to 800 megawatts of energy. That will be the first unit we completed. And we're working hard to make sure that that is completed by December. Now, you've seen in the media the reports about all the contractual problems. Those are the problems they have on any large contract. I don't know if any honorable members have had the unfortunate experience of having a builder at their own house. Anyone who has will know the difference between the plan that they give you when they start and the actual problems when they're busy is enormous. And you know, all of your projects are tiny projects compared to a Medupi. Medupi, when it is complete, will be a project that will cost something like 91 billion rand. It is one of the world's largest coal-fired power stations. It's being done after, for more than 20 years, South Africa allowed its knowledge base in building large power stations to go to waste. We didn't build any large power stations for a generation. So we're relearning the skills of building these large power stations domestically. When the degree is done, it would be an expensive but important school fees that we paid. And we would then hope that the next program and the one thereafter will be quicker and cheaper because we've learned out of this experience in Medupi. Then we look at what percent of construction is complete. Now every quarter we track that and Cabinet gets that information. How much have we spent? That's tracked. How much have we spent in the 3 months? Not just how much have we spent to date, but in the 3 months. How many jobs are there? How much are we spending on localization? And what are the problems? And so here we'll pick up and we'll report to Cabinet the problems that we may be facing with Medupi. So I should just indicate, in the case of Medupi, it's the fourth largest coal-fired power station in the world. It's also the world's largest dry-cooled power station. So it's in an area where water is scarce, but coal is abundant. Sitting basically on a coal field. And so you've got to manage the geography. You've got coal, but you don't have water. So you've got to pump water in. You've got to design the power station not to be a big user of water. So it's what I call a dry-cooled power station. This will be the world's biggest dry-cooled power station. So what we see in the media, the problems that we're hitting, some of those are the ones because we are pioneer in this field. And by the end of 2013, our hope is the first power comes in. If we're successful, and the committee will know by next year whether we're successful, when we generate 794 megawatts of energy, that's just a random number I'm giving you. That number is more than the entire energy supply of Mozambique. Just that one unit of Medupi, and Medupi will have about six or so units, but just that one unit is more than the entire energy of Mozambique. So you can see how big these things are. When Medupi is completed, all of it, it will be 4.7 gigawatts, or 4,700 megawatts of energy. That is probably, I would not be surprised if that is about half Nigeria's total energy. That's just one power station. So it would be really great if at some stage the committee did a site visit to Medupi just to see the scale of this thing. It's huge. And because it's not near one of the cities, it's not as visible as the stadiums, but it's a much, much bigger project than Sock City and the Cape Town Stadium combined, and the Durban Stadium thrown in. In scale, it is really, really, I mean, think of it, 91 billion rand we're spending on that one. And it will last us for the next 50, 60, 70 years. It will be a reliable source of energy for the country. EDD's role, monitor every quarter, underspinning by Eskom, call them in, ask them for reasons, ask them for a turnaround plan, take that information, present it to Cabinet, monitor the job numbers, check the localization program at Medupi, and we track the amount that is spent on localization every quarter, identify long-term problems. We know now the labor issue may be a challenge in the long run, so we've got to come up with a different industrial relations environment in Medupi. Work out the skills. We've done a skills program around Medupi, in fact around all the power stations now, so we've got information on the skills need of a power station build. That's the kind of work we do. What does Eskom do? Eskom manages the day-to-day running of the operation. So that's the difference. We don't get involved as EDD in the actual build program. That's left to Eskom to manage with the big construction companies and their subcontracts. Our role is these bits of information that I've indicated. Spending, localization, jobs, underperformance on contract, and meeting deadlines. Those are the areas we keep an eye on. And we're the eyes and ears of Cabinet in doing that. So Cabinet now has, for the first time, a comprehensive dashboard that shows for every project. This kind of example is on the screen. Is now presented for every major project. And the cumulative effect of all of this is very, very substantial. If I look at the 114 projects that we reported at the last cabinet meeting on, their value is 899 billion rand. It's just those projects that are under construction, that have given cabinet information as EDD, that is a project worth 899 billion rand. And with a direct jobs of 145,860, so call it 150,000. And the quarter spend in September, quarter ending in September, was about 24 billion rand. So that's all monitored, fed in quality control, double check to make sure the information is accurate, given to cabinet, and cabinet then plays its role to ensure that the infrastructure program takes off. PICC. Yes, the PICC reports directly to cabinet, and all of the information. This is of course a core cabinet-driven program. Half of cabinet sits on the PICC. All the premiers, all nine premiers sit on the PICC. The metro mayors are all on there. So when we have a major report, we take all of them through it, and we give them the high-level pictures, and then we that report is then submitted through the cabinet structures.
To the portfolio committee, how do we,
I'll just follow
the cabinet which is doing the oversight of the PICC.
Yeah.
Then what about the committee?
Yes.
Also doing the oversight.
Yeah. Now on the example I've given of Medupi, the Energy Portfolio Committee would have direct responsibility. Then, in fact, one of the challenges, DJ, I spoke about, was it yesterday, is I'm getting increasing requests from portfolio committees to come and do a presentation on the PICC. So the Water Portfolio Committee wanted us to come and do a presentation tomorrow. And it will be impossible because we'll have to go basically to every infrastructure portfolio committee because PICC's work is cross-cutting. It's transport, it's communication, it's water, it's energy, it's higher education and training, it's the school board programs, that's basic education. You can just go through each of them and you'll see it's there. So up to now, oversight is done through the committee system of parliament on the individual projects. What may be useful is if, and this may be the right portfolio committee to do it, if the Economic Development Portfolio Committee, together with all the infrastructure-related portfolio committees and the services committees like education, did a joint briefing session where we could come as PICC, a couple of ministers, and I could, on behalf of the PICC, do a presentation to all of the portfolio committees on how the PICC work, so that we then are able to ensure that the water that Honorable Johnny DeLange and his committee, when they sit on water, they can see the PICC angle there. But this program is massive. I mean, I've given you the sense here, and it's not driven only by me in economic development. As I say, half of cabinet sits on the PICC. EDD provides the technical services. So that's what the department does. But it's not a departmental program. The PICC don't fall under PICC, under EDD. The PICC falls under the presidency. EDD provides the technical services. I head the secretariat of the PICC. What is the secretariat? The secretariat is made up of a number of cabinet members. Ministers and deputy ministers. They are the secretariat. They meet roughly every 2 weeks and they get detailed reports, much more detailed than cabinet gets, and they unblock and solve the individual problems. Okay. I'm pausing because this is a Q&A session, so members, your chair was very generous with her time, so she wants you to use all of the time. You can't let it down. Chair, you have the floor.
Thank you very much, Mr. I tried to follow you while I was doing my work in my office. I just want to find out, just on this particular Medupi, Okay, just on the issue that you just raised, yes, I'm intending to write to the House Chair so that he helps in coordinating with other portfolio committees that are infrastructure related, both economic and social infrastructure related, so that we have a joint presentation with them. I think that would help. Otherwise, it would help to have it at an economic cluster level, which I think it will then, you know, not include the social cluster people. So it's better if it's coordinated at that level, so that at the House Chair level, so that we include also the social cluster. The question that I had is around the middle. The objective there, you say it's going to produce more than, you know, what we require as a country in terms of energy. What is the intention of that? Are we intending to supply other countries in the region? Because my understanding is this is the inter and intra kind of support for Africa. What will happen then to other energy produced by in other areas of or in other parts of Africa? I'm not sure whether we're intending to supply what part of Africa, and in total, if we were to compare what South Africa is able to produce and what other neighboring, and also whether it's central, north Africa, they are able to produce. Combined, what will give us as a whole? I'm just asking that question for Africa sustainance, energy sustainance, sustainable issues.
Thank you, Chair. I think if I gave the impression that we're going to produce more energy than we need, and I must correct that. I think what I am saying is that we're producing just in Medupi alone more energy than probably all our neighbors put together is using at the moment. Now we have with our neighboring country something called the common energy pool. So what we do is all of us produce our energy, but we help each other when there's a shortage. Because energy is not something you can plan precisely. You don't know how many people have to switch on their lights or the heaters. There's a cold spell in Joburg, suddenly every person switch on the heaters and the energy spikes. Now at that point when it spikes, Eskom's supply may be too short, and Eskom has got this marvelous control room where they can see immediately that the energy levels are now at critical point, and they can effectively tap into the energy that is generated in Mozambique or any of the other neighboring countries. But it also goes the other way. If one of our neighboring countries have a spike in their energy use, because there's a cold spell in Botswana or somewhere, then they can tap into our one. It's a part of creating not only for purposes of regional integration, but it's a smart way of managing your energy so that you don't have to produce more energy constantly than what you need and pay for it. Because remember, electricity, you're burning coal. So whether you use it or not, it's on forever. Unlike laptops, if you produce too many laptops, you can store them. Someone take them out tomorrow. Energy is not like that. When you produce them, you burn the coal. It's gone. So, you know, if you don't use them, they get dissipated. They basically go to waste. Now, I think, Chair, you asked a very interesting question, which I haven't even begun to port here, which is, what is our overall continental energy vision? In the DRC, there's a river called the Inga River. The Inga River is quite a strange river. It's a large river. It's not the largest river on the continent, it's a large river. But the geology of that river is so interesting that it means you can build an enormous hydroelectric power station there. So if we can sort out the political challenges, we can build a set of power stations on that river that can theoretically produce 40,000 megawatts of energy. What is 40,000? 40,000 is almost
the same amount of energy as all of our power stations in South Africa combined. The nuclear power station here in Cape Town, plus all the big Mpumalanga power stations, plus what you're seeing in other smaller power stations in other parts of the country. All of that together is only a bit larger than what we can get from one river. It will be cheap, because hydro energy is generally much cheaper than coal, because nature does work. Instead of you having to dig the pole and put it in, the flow of the water creates the energy with the turbines. It's clean, you don't burn anything, you just use the power of that river. And it's in the center of Africa, so it can be moved. If you move energy very long distance, you lose some of that energy. You know the energy that comes on the transmission lines, if you take the highway and you drive long distance in the country. By the time the energy goes from Mpumalanga to Cape Town, some of it is lost on the lines. So the further you move energy, the more energy you lose. So you've got to use it quite close by. If we can do, so what did we do on Inga? As part of the work of government, we've now signed an MOU with the government of the DRC. We're working now on the engineering side of what we required to do a major investment. It will cost enormous sums of money. I mean, Medupi, with 4,000 megawatts, costs almost 100 billion rand. So you can imagine Graninga will be, you know, almost 10 times larger in the energy supply that it will do. But it can transform the African continent. It can turn, it can industrialize Africa, because it can provide cheap energy in the DRC, Angola, Ghana, right around up to Nigeria. We can lay those lines. We can move into parts of East Africa, and some of it can even come as far as South Africa. So we want to be a big part of that success story. But there are huge problems there. Some technical challenges of an engineering kind that we think can be solved, but the main issue is you need a stable political environment, because no one is going to put a sum of money in when the resources can be at risk due to political instability, if I can put it very diplomatically.
I'm saying, as we know, that our core economic threat is in coal. Let's say if we move to this water in Congo, what about our coal? When are we going to use it as our strength? Thanks.
I think we'll keep on using coal, even while we're using hydro, because our economy is expanding. So remember, Graninga is not going to come into being for at least another 10 years. It's such a huge project that it will take, you know, when China first talked about its huge new dam project, it was, I think, under Mao Zedong, so in the late 60s. It took them probably two generations to get it completely off the ground. So Graninga is so huge that it's work that will occupy us for a long time. But we can't rely only. Our country goes for energy security. No country is going to put itself at a risk where all of its energy comes from another country. Things change, politics change. You could have a technical problem with the lines. You could have an earthquake that damages that. So you've got to spread your risks. So we will always, in our energy mix, a portion of that energy mix will come from coal-fired power stations. But we also have to manage our carbon emissions, because we are a very large emitter of CO2. We send a lot of damage into the atmosphere because of coal, because of mining, and because of SASOL, which does conversion of coal to oil. But at the same time, we can't walk away from coal, because as Honorable Ntuli says, it is a natural resource. It's something that gives us a competitive edge. At the moment, coal power is still cheaper than renewable energy. So we use coal to subsidize solar and wind. but no. I know when you read the newspapers, people will say, no, you know, it costs the same, but coal is still cheaper. But we can't only look at costs in the long term. We also have to look at our responsibility to the planet. So it's trying to find the balance between these different things that constitutes our policy. We set it out in the integrated resource plan, which is the energy driver of the new growth path. And in there, the Department of Energy did the technical work for it. It sets out the country vision up to 2030 on energy. And so Gran Inga won't damage our use of our coal resources. Honorable Mugo.
Thank you, Minister, for that response. Just take that discussion a little bit further. I was reading somewhere about someone commenting on the Grand Inga project and saying that the GRC is such an unstable country that South Africa pumping in so much money to develop this project is really like throwing money in a bottomless pit. And then this person made also a reference to Kabarabas in the 70s, I think it was, when that project was stalled for quite a long time because of the liberation struggle, the war, and only picked up after that. Is this, I don't want to connect the two, this project with the co-involvement that is Tali in the GRC, that we're sending our troops because we have got this to protect this investment that we're making there. But one way or other, one has to connect this anyway, because it's like, of course, we're contributing to peace in that country. But should we look at this also in that context? That is because of what the interest that we have, the economic interest that we have in the GRC. Another question is the issue of subsidizing or providing subsidized cost of energy to certain industries. There's been talk of BHP Billiton getting concessionary rates from Eskom, and it's been opposed in certain circles because they think that BHP Billiton can afford to pay the rates that are demanded by everybody else. What do you think is the reason why we should do this to a particular industry, not to others? I mean, I'm talking about in terms of, if you're talking about competition, why not allow other industries also to enjoy the same privilege? Why only a specific industry? Thank you.
Well, I'm mindful that we are in open session, so the comments I want to make about neighboring countries have to recognize that these are delicate matters that we're working through. But nonetheless, I'd like to answer the question. I think the first thing is, if we look at the Kahorabasa program, there was a lot of skepticism about it in the past. But the energy supply of the large programs like that are absolutely key to the energy supply of South Africa. We're working now, by the way, with Mozambique, I know it's a slightly different point, to unlock new energy running down from northern Mozambique through to Maputo, and then hooking up Maputo with South Africa, because Mozambique is a net supplier of energy to South Africa. We use energy that is produced in Mozambique in our national power grid. On the big issue around the DRC and investment in Gran Inga, yes, there are risks. There are risks. But we can't let Afro-pessimism drag us down. Those risks have to be managed and mitigated. One of the key conditions, political stability. In the end, the African Union will have to create the basis for stable politics. Who wins an election or not should not be its issue. But that you only come into power through the ballot box must be something that we entrench on the continent. Why is there often so much instability on the continent? It's because of the fight over natural resources. big powers outside of this continent see enormous economic opportunity in Africa's resources. Remember, for more than a century now, Africa has been the provider of raw materials to Europe and elsewhere. So this is a very rich continent in resources, and has always been a battle throughout the 20th century, for much of the 19th century. In fact, colonialism's economic motivation was to utilize the natural resources of the African continent. So I think it's ultimately up to the African Union and the bigger countries in Africa, Nigeria, Egypt, South Africa, and the other big ones, to help ensure that we have a stable politics on the continent. In the end, South Africa cannot grow unless the continent stabilizes and grows at the rates that it does. We are 51 million people. We are a member of BRICS, the next biggest BRICS country, three times as large as us. Brazil is four times as large as us. China and India is probably 14, 15 times larger than us. So Africa is our market that we need to aim for. There's a billion people on the continent, but it requires stability. And that means coordinated action by African countries to create stability across the continent. The detail of that, the International Relations Portfolio Committee may want to talk about, rather than something that I am particularly equipped to deal with. It's another mandate, not my mandate. But in my mandate and economic development, I can see very clearly that we need that stability. Unavoidably, if we are to unlock Grandinga, there's going to have to be a package of measures that all of the neighboring countries will have to agree, including security of the major installations on the Ingerva. That's just how it will have to be. If you look at big international projects, that's what's done elsewhere. So I think even though there will be a big debate in the society over one or two decisions of government on foreign relations, there needs to be a closing of ranks on the issue that Africa's stability is vital. Foreign interference in Africa, as in big powers coming in and playing on our continent, is to be discouraged. Coups are by definition a bad thing, and that we ought to promote observance of democratic practices on the continent. Coming to the question more at home, where I can speak more freely, we inherited a contractual arrangement between Eskom and these large users of energy in Richards Bay. And there's a couple of issues. From where I sit, Eskom's tariffs ought not to favor these big smelters. They ought to favor labor-intensive sectors of the economy. But Eskom says, look, we have a contract. It's a legally binding contract. It's with a counterparty that can take us to court. If you say the contract is inappropriate, well, we are the current management. We have to honor all the contracts that our predecessors have put into place. And this, of course, the contract is void on the basis it was corruptly entered in. So if there's no corruption allegation, it's a legally binding contract. In a society with rule of law, you've got to carry it out. So that would be their argument. When we ask them now, why do you think this has been put in? They say, we're running a energy surplus as we did many years ago. You're producing energy that is going to waste. So you need a big off-taker, a couple of companies that uses huge resources of energy. These companies like BHP Billiton and so on were that. They invested heavily. You know what they do there? Basically, the production of aluminium, the big feedstock is something called bauxite. We import bauxite mainly from Australia. Aluminium is a combination of two things, bauxite and energy. So you could always say it's bauxite and coal, but coal in the form of energy, and that produces aluminium. So the company will obviously point out to their legal rights. Would we recommend that kind of contract today? Absolutely not. But it's like any contract that you inherit. You are bound by its terms, and exiting from a contract like that could be potentially quite expensive. So I think they are, the regulators are looking at this. There's been a lot of public focus on this issue, and it's something of the past that we're managing. It's not something that we will promote for the future. If we want to have differentiated tariffs, we would prefer to have a differentiated tariff that supports small companies and labor-intensive sectors. So I hope that answers the question on the existing major smelters.
Okay, I think the question that I asked is quite was favorably answered. I just want to continue on the skills, as general skills. I can see in terms of the presentations that you, have entered into a memorandum of intent with the Engineering Council of South Africa. What interests me is the MOI on immediate skills shortage. What would you be addressing there in terms of that? If you say you have immediate interventions, short-term interventions in terms of our immediate needs, what does that mean in terms of sourcing out this scarce skill? And in which areas of engineering, for instance, are we mostly under-resourced? Or is it generic engineering challenges? I'm happy that you also alluded to the challenge, environmental challenges around the coal power stations. It has been a concern, especially from the environmental organizations. So yes, but perhaps if we were to look into that, what is it that we are doing, for instance, in South Africa to minimize that kind of pollution. I just want to hear from you. I've been hearing a lot of around the news that has been created. I was also interested in Kaurabaza just to get an indication as to the capacity left there. Is it still producing electricity? And what percentage is the energy you're talking about that we are sourcing from Mozambique? A significant percentage of what we generally are sourcing from elsewhere, or even providing other countries. We have in this kind of distribution to the neighboring countries, have memorandum of understanding around supply of such resources to them, like energy. I think I must end in terms of the energy issues. I wanted to venture into issues of the marine. What do they call it? Maritime, yes, that's the correct. You know, some of this language we're not used to. Yes.
But you also come from a province without an ocean.
Yes, that could be an added challenge. Why the show? You're coming far away from there, from the fiercely side of Mozambique there. Okay. I'm just concerned about issues of security. In dealing with this inter-Africa development and so forth, I was also looking into such issues. I know there are committees in place that are dealing with security matters, but I just want to be sure whether in implementing some of these projects, are we not putting ourselves at risk, or South Africans at risk? I'm asking this question purely on from a layman's position, Minister. Very ignorant, not having any clue as to what is happening. And I'd want you to perhaps try and educate us, because we hear a lot of things in the media around security issues. We hear what's happening in other countries in terms of, what are the spells in the sea called? The pirates, yes, pirating in the sea and so forth. Don't laugh at me, sir. Buccaneers, eh? Yes, the Buccaneers, that's a better way to. Pirates. But did you hear me? I said pirates. Yes, Minister, those are my questions.
No, thank you very much. Let me start with Kabora Rasa Dam and the power station. I think if there's an interest, we could do a more detailed briefing. Just by way of a little bit of background, honourable members will recall that the hydro energy project was originally put together in the late 70s, and it was about just short of 2,000 megawatts of energy. I think 1,920 megawatts. Which makes it large, but nothing as big as the ones that we do nowadays. So it is less than half the size that Medupi will be. And it's connected to the South African power grid, and we rely on it. But obviously it's a relatively small portion of the national one, but when your energy is tight, even a small bit of energy can make a big difference. The whole program around Kaurabasa was put on hold during the period of the war in Mozambique. So up to about from, I think, the mid-80s to about the mid-90s, till about 1996, 1997, the project was effectively not fully operational. After the peace treaty in Mozambique that brought Renamo into Mozambican politics, energy supply continued. And in fact, about 7-8 years ago, in about the mid 2006-2007, there was a major refurbishing of some of the valves in Kaurabasa. So it's an important part of the total energy generating capacity in the region. It's not one that we totally depend on, but as part of our energy mix, it's quite important. If that was cut off, it would have a very negative effect on South Africa. And therefore, when we tried to talk about, during the time when there were Eskom shortages, and people were saying we should just cut off certain neighboring countries' energy, it was not a very thoughtful set of comments, because if neighbors had to cut off our energy, then we would be in bigger trouble than we are now. So we are depending on Mozambican energy for part of our energy mix. And it's not a bad thing. It's part of regional development. And as long as we're not totally dependent, so we will always create a capacity locally to generate some of our energy while we import other energy from neighboring countries. Chair, you've asked the interesting question around the maritime industry as a whole, and there are different components to it. I'll deal more briefly with the pirates or the buccaneers, as you call them, challenge, and I look at Honorable Mabasa. That's one element of it. We've been concerned that the kind of pirate activities that we've seen on the East Coast should not begin to really manifest itself on the West Coast. And you've seen some newspaper reports that indicate challenges there. The South African Navy must play a role in keeping the sea lanes open. If Africa is cut off from
trade with the rest of the world because of piracy, because of problems like that, the continent will face enormous problems, because the population is growing, people's expectations are rising, and we've got to create the growth and jobs for a growing number of urban Africans, not just in South Africa, all over the continent. So I think our efforts are intended to help create the... One of the responsibilities of being the largest economy on the continent is we benefit. We, as I said, 25,000 new jobs just in the last 2 years were created from things we sell to the rest of Africa. With size go responsibility. Burundi won't be able to finance the kind of programs that will keep our sea lanes open. We can't constantly rely on United States, France, China to keep Africa's sea lanes and trade routes open. Ultimately, Africans must take responsibility for their own future. With it comes risks, and there's a legitimate public debate about whether we should put in this way or that way, in this area or that area. But in the end, there has to be a closing of ranks on the fact that we have a responsibility to ensure that Africa remains part of the economic mainstream. If there is a big appetite by the committee for a more detailed briefing, I can talk to my colleague, the Minister of International Relations and Cooperation, because she coordinates a lot more of our work and our thinking on the specifics, and it isn't an area we can take up. In the past, what has happened is occupying powers have kept the peace on the continent. Is that where we want to be in the 21st century? So as they pull out, and some of them pull out because of their own fiscal problems, the Europeans are facing increasing fiscal problems, so they're still on the continent in a big way. But as they pull out, who holds the peace? And we say the AU has to take on more and more of that responsibility. We can retreat as South Africans only into our own economy, but then we're going to grow at this tiny rate. Or we can create the political conditions on the sea lanes, inside the different economies in which Africans can increasingly trade with each other and have roads that are free. You know, if you drove in Mozambique 20 years ago, there were lots of stories about problems. Your cars get shot at, you stop by bandits and so on. Today, most parts of Mozambique are places you can travel. So Mozambique has seen a massive explosion of tourism. I'm sorry, it's a terrible word to use in the context of Mozambique. Let's say a rapid expansion, not explosion, of tourism. South Africans going to holiday in Maputo and on the islands and so on. That is good for South Africa, because if we don't develop the rest of the continent, more Africans from other neighboring countries will out of desperation come to South Africa. And then we have enormous pressures on our health systems, our transport, fights for jobs and so on. So you've got to do both. You've got to protect your own interests, but you also have a responsibility towards neighbors as part of looking after your own long-term interests. So I want us to see the economic benefits to South Africa of the role we play in the continent and the opportunities that we can get. But with that goes some risks. So this Chair, you're right, there are risks that come from it. But I think in general we can't shy away from those risks. And that doesn't mean that every individual instance of involvement is one that government will support. We may decide not to take part in some peacekeeping forces and so on. The bigger question on the marine thing is the maritime trade, which includes things like shipbuilding, where we've got the opportunity to grow jobs in South Africa, transshipment hub. We're building the port of Nuka as an important transshipment hub, and now deepening the port, they're dredging, they've got this huge dredging operation there where they're basically sucking sea sand up to deepen the port. We're building a container terminal there that can move big containers coming from China or India to Brazil. It gets offloaded there, repackaged, and sent off to Brazil or to Europe, creating jobs for local people in the process. Finally, there's been a lot of debate publicly about whether we should have a shipping line, a South African shipping line. It's been raised by the Gulf Arab states have noted that the absence of a shipping line has been that there's not been as much direct trade. So these are all parts of what perhaps EDD may do some work in future on the maritime sector. Cabinet has begun to just signal it as an area that needs more work. But currently, we don't have the internal knowledge base in EDD on this area to rapidly roll out a program of planning, research, and implementation on the shipping line. So where we're confining ourselves is expanding our harbors. Saldanha in the Western Cape is part of Sub 5, and we're looking at how we can expand that and also tap into the West Coast gas. And on the East Coast, as I've indicated, the Durban Deepwater Port is the mega project. It will be massive if it is eventually launched. And the other big one is the port of Nguha. So that's the area on maritime. Not as big a work program as we'd like, but one that is has at least got an infrastructure link to it.
Too much information. And on engineering?
Sorry about that question. The skills issue. We've now identified what we've done is the work isn't complete yet, but it's quite close to completion, and then we want to take it through a series of stakeholder processes. We've taken all 18 SIPs. We've done an initial skills demand curve for each one, broken down by engineers, artisans, other professional skills, lower level skills that's required, back of office skills like procurement and so on. So all of that has now been done, completed. We've taken those 18 and we've aggregated it, and we've got a draft national skills demand curve. We will now take this to the HRD Council, and after it's gone through the HRD Council and some discussions with the civil engineering industry, it may be a good time to also prepare something like that for parliamentarians to engage, and maybe a joint session between economic development and higher education and training could be useful, and we could make some of that available. We don't yet feel confident enough to put it in the public domain, but we can certainly, after we take it through the HRP Council, I think we can bring it to a joint PC. We've identified six categories of scarce skills. And I have the information on my laptop what each of those categories are and roughly, very roughly, what the numbers may look like over the next 15 to 20 years. And so I would be happy perhaps as soon as we've done the one more leg, which is to take through the HRD Council to do a presentation on the skills needs and which categories are the biggest gaps that we have. Not all of engineering are equally affected, so we'll be able to indicate where the problems lie in the engineering. Not all of engineering's problems are the same. In many cases, it's not lack of engineering graduates. It's lack of placement opportunities to allow people to complete the experiential part of their work that allows them to qualify as engineers. Not all of our problems are a result of our own actions. South African engineers are very highly rated internationally. So when you go to Dubai or you go to Qatar or Abu Dhabi, you will find that a lot of the big projects there are managed by South African engineers and project managers. You know, if you go to Dubai as an example, there's this hotel that many people have commented on that juts out into the ocean called Burj Al Arab. It was a South African project. If you look at some of the transport systems that have been developed, South African engineers have been involved. So what they do is they basically attract engineers from countries that they rate very highly by paying sky high salaries. They don't have to pay the cost of training the people. They can just pay them a high salary. So we will always produce more engineers than we need in order to acknowledge that engineers are mobile. They can go anywhere in the world because there's always a demand for good engineers. We now measure through higher education and training the number of engineers we produce at universities. And Minister Nzimande, I think it's outcome five, presents that information to us every quarter on what the trends are on engineering equipment by universities and graduation rates. So that's where we are in the engineering. So I'd be happy to share the information on the six categories with the portfolio committee in a presentation on infrastructure and skills. And that may be quite a useful presentation because the infrastructure program is so big that if we try to take the whole of it, we could keep you here for 4 weeks every day, and we still don't cover everything. It's very, very detailed. But if we took infrastructure and skills maybe as one area, and the other area could be infrastructure and localization. Those could be strong economic development focus areas where the committee would be able to receive reports on what we do.
Our oversight.
With the power invested in me, you have the floor, Honourable.
The oversight by the committee, I did ask that whether where do we come in? Do we come in only on the infrastructure, the monitoring or oversight and coordination? Otherwise, how can we oversight the infrastructure?
Honourable Mbasa, you could also pass, take the floor.
Thanks, Honourable Minister. My apology to the meeting. I have not been very well, and the exhaustion takes its toll. Patriotism and nation building. I think if we don't do very well in those two areas, it means that our costs of exporting skills, you know, will not be having a counter. So I don't know what comment you would make on that, Minister.
Okay, well, let me start with Honorable Ntuli. I wanted to keep for last your question on the infrastructure bill and link it to one of the issues around what the committee no doubt would want to do. But the question that Honorable Mbasa asked is also a very cross-cutting one, so I'll come to the bill now. The Infrastructure Development Bill has been published for public comment. It was crafted last year based on our experience. It contains a number of different provisions. Based on the public comment, we may amend it, submit it then to Cabinet, and once it's gone through the cabinet process and been supported at cabinet, it will then be submitted to parliament and it will be tabled by the speaker. Once it's tabled by the speaker, it will come to the committee and the committee then takes ownership of the bill and will then do the various processes around the bill. What is the bill trying to do? The bill is a facilitation of infrastructure. So it sets up the PICC structures and processes. But then from there, what the bill does, it also simplifies the regulatory processes for infrastructure. And it does so in a number of ways. One, through bringing different departments together in a statutory framework. And when I do the presentation on the bill, I will have to take the portfolio committee in a lot of detail through it. But essentially, it creates an interdepartmental steering committee where every department that has an interest in that project must come. where permission and regulatory approvals must be coordinated. In other words, you can't get your environmental impact assessment but not a water license. Or you get a water license, but the local government don't give you zoning permission. It's one package of regulatory approval that will be given at one go. And that's very important to unlock and speed up infrastructure. And then the bill also sets some time frames around environmental impact assessments, and it has a few other clauses to speed up matters like expropriation of land that you'll need for infrastructure. The committee's role, my earlier suggestion was that it would be very helpful, and the chair picked it up in respect of her comments about writing to the house chair. It will be very useful if we can give an overall presentation on the PICC to a number of different committees. But there are some areas of the infrastructure work of the department that are vital to the Economic Development Portfolio Committee's own focus. Honorable Mabasa asked one of it earlier, small business and co-ops. The chair asked a question now, infrastructure and skills. I raised the issue in the presentation in the early session this morning, infrastructure and localization. So those are all areas that I think the committee has to play quite a key role. The other part that we work on as a department on infrastructure is the competition side. And members may be aware of the fact that we've done this big probe through the Competition Commission of price fixing and collusion in the construction sector by the big companies. We have about 400 admissions of guilt now by large companies. We've seen collusion and price fixing in many, many projects. And this is all by the private sector, where they collude and they carve up the market between themselves. So we take very firm action against that as government, and that's another area that the committee would need to be seized with, which is the structure of the construction industry and its practices. All of the KPIs, even the ones that don't refer to infrastructure, may well have an infrastructure component. So small business don't refer to infrastructure, but the committee should be asking us what we're doing to connect small business development with infrastructure. We won't in every case have the integration right, for all sorts of reasons. But that is what the committee and the department needs to do. Constantly make sure we integrate the different areas. It may be good to do a site visit to some of the large infrastructure programs and get a presentation on how government is integrating its work to achieve its development objectives. And Medupi may well be a good one, or Kusile, or one of the others, perhaps one of the big dams, maybe one of the big transport programs. The committee, once it's worked out what it wants to do, we can facilitate that. And you can do an on-site inspection together with a meeting with the relevant parties. Honorable Mabasa, what can I say but yes? I know it's the first time in a long time that you've asked a question without co-ops in it, but it's nonetheless I was at BRICS summit recently, honorable members, and I met with Brazilian business people at the launch of the BRICS Business Council. Brazil's current growth rate is lower than South Africa. I don't know if honorable members knew this. Our growth rate is higher than that of Brazil right now for the last 12 months. Brazilian businesses are very upbeat about Brazil. They know it's a temporary slump. They know that they are laying the foundations of their own long-term growth. So we mustn't paper over our problems. We do need to be on our toes. We need to hold our public institutions to account. But a sense of patriotism and optimism about the future is part of the success that we need. If we talk ourselves into pessimism, into believing we are a failed state, into believing that everything is going wrong. We are not going to achieve anything. I presented in Parliament in February during the debate on the State of the Nation Address some outcomes of the Ernst & Young survey. It was very interesting. I may refer again to it in future meetings of the committee, but very interesting. Ernst & Young, they're not a South African company, they're an international company. They make six major points about Africa. And their most important point is that in spite of Africa's growing success, there's still many out there outside of Africa that are pessimistic about the continent. And Ernst & Young, a Western consultancy, not an African consultancy, says it's necessary to tell Africa's story and Africa's successes confidently and consistently, because telling the successes is part of creating the successes. And then they say the two big things that need to be done to build on Africa's successes are regional integration, and they point with a lot of they point to the most successful example, the program launched by President Zuma to connect the three major economic zones into an FTA that will encompass 600 million people. This is not Ernst & Young saying it. And the second biggest thing they say Africa needs to do is infrastructure. And they point to the South African infrastructure program as the best example. And then Ernst & Young, after they did this report, they did a survey of, I think about 500, I'm just going on memory now, about 500 business people globally on sentiment towards Africa. And the country that is ranked the highest in investor confidence is South Africa, in that sample survey. And that survey was done in January this year. In other words, after Baikana and after the farm workers' strike. And yet, sentiment towards South Africa from serious investors was very positive. And so I think we need to find inside the country a self-belief, critical where we get it wrong, and we need to be critical of our own weaknesses and mistakes, but also recognizing the successes of our programs and so on. And that's the patriotism we're talking about, the nation building that we're talking about. Young people must believe in the future of this country. And so I, even though there will be many challenges in the infrastructure program, it's the nature of, as I said, and I saw Honorable Bubu was smiling very much like he's had personal experience of this, if you've ever built anything in your own house with boulder, you will know things go wrong. It's the nature of building or renovating, things go wrong. If you try to build in stuff, I feel even sorrier for him, because it's a lot of stress to do own building, and many people do own building, but it's very, lots of things go wrong. So in that infrastructure ball program, here and there, the ball will be dropped, but we'll pick up the ball. We will pick it up. We will solve the issues. And we will, I think, lay the foundation for a very, very successful future for ourselves and our children using the infrastructure program. So, Chair, I'm going to check if there are any other questions, because if there are none, then I really want to give over to you for closing comment. This was an unusual workshop session. It's not a long presentation, but it's Q&A. I'm finding it very helpful. In fact, more helpful than us spending an hour and a half giving you slides on the screen and then not answering your questions that you have. Honorable Hussein, you have the floor.
Yes, I must agree that this has been extremely beneficial, and I would like to recommend we do this at least once a quarter. It will be very interesting. I would like to suggest that we try and do this at least once a quarter. It gives us a whole host of information. So thank you very much. It's been very beneficial. Mr. Mayor, I just ask one question. That is the reference to the infrastructure world. And I know we'll deal with it at some stage, but at the heart of it is again bringing things together to try and coordinate across all of the various departments and massive infrastructure projects. If you had listened to my comments earlier on, you would pick up from there whether or not we are in generally in support of the principle of what it does. But one of the key things that have concerned that that we picked up on the book was the absence of effective oversight, because it's a mechanism that's in somewhere else. And I would like to quiz you on whether or not you see that changing. And do you envisage there to be a stronger parliamentary oversight facility built into the bill, into the, when it becomes an active issue, that will be built into it? So I'd like your comments on just that. I gather you have picked that up from the public comment from quite a bit of different sources as well, on the lack of political oversight from a parliamentary perspective on the bill.
Thank you. I've seen some comments that have and representations have been made verbally to me on that that aspect, but I think in a more detailed discussion, which is the kind of discussion we can have when the bill itself is tabled, I would be very happy to talk through that, because I think some of that may be based on a misunderstanding on what the bill is seeking to do, and another part of it may well be legitimate, and we would separate out those two. Responsibility for ensuring that the program is run is that ultimately of the line department. So if the Mzumvubu Dam is going to be built, ultimately the Department of Water Affairs will be the line department through which we put the budget. And that money will come via the PICC, and it certainly won't come via EDD. So fundamental must be Parliament, must be the authority that holds the Department of Water accountable for the spending of that money and for the issues around that. The creation of the PICC should not and will not lessen that accountability in any way. Absolutely not. But what the PICC will do is make sure that instead of us sitting for a long time, because you know the Mzumvubu Dam has been spoken of since the 1960s, it's time to stop talking and begin site clearing. So that's what our role is. But then once it happens, making sure that the money is spent properly, making sure that the department is accountable, that is absolutely without any question going to be in accordance with the existing rules of Parliament. And where I think the misunderstanding arose is some commentators thought that all infrastructure money will come via the PICC. We unblock. So what the PICC did last year, we sat down with Treasury. We went through all infrastructure programs with Treasury. We identified where we thought there is capacity to spend faster and where we thought there is no capacity. Based on that engagement, Treasury took that into account in working out where to reprioritize money. So in the appropriation process, as well as in February budget process, you saw Minister Gordon made a number of key announcements about shifting of funds. All of that then ultimately is in those line departments. The money don't come to EDD. It goes to that line department. We will ask that the water gets more money, or we will ask that basic education gets more money, or we will ask that energy gets more money. That's our role. But that doesn't mean the money comes via us. It goes straight from Treasury through the Parliament vote to that department. That department must continue to be accountable to Parliament. No compromise on that issue. That's how a democracy is built. Parliament must have oversight of the executive in that. But it's not the PICC that will have the fund. It will be the line departments. If there are no other questions, honourable members, thank you very much for the opportunity we got, and may I hand over to the chair.
Minister, thank you very much. I think this really has added more information to the little that we had, and I know that you've been trying to give us as much information as possible. And sometimes I've been feeling guilty that I attend some of these conferences and workshops, and members don't have that opportunity, even sometimes through your conferences you invite all of us. I'm happy that today members had an opportunity of asking questions, and you did give us responses according to your area of competence, obviously. I had one last question, but and I thought I should just put it aside for now. It's related to transport and it's in relation to the new PASA awarding of contract, new contract. And my question was going to relate to the localization issues. I know that we are all concerned about issues of localization. Wherein we're going to, that's why I was asking questions around engineering challenges that we have. But I guess that can still come later on, it's fine. Minister, we don't think that the President made a mistake by appointing yourself and Minister Nkwinti to process the implementation planning of this PICC. I think by the fact that Mr. Nkwinti is in the rural development and we're in the economic development, I think that to me was the well-calculated way of appointing yourself to lead this particular, I always say it's quite an ambitious program for South Africa, especially with the responsibility that we've given ourselves over the continent integration. It's not just a small task. I can see the President is moving around Niger, Nigeria, he's been there in the Botswana and so forth. I think this is really helping us a lot in ensuring that we make Africa for Africans, work for Africa, work for Africans, and through the efforts of Africans. And I think when we say Africa for Africans, by Africans, we really meant that. And it's in that spirit that we see what's happening. And we want to ensure that we also do what the Honorable Hussein is requesting, that we have a quarterly briefings. Where possible with other portfolio committees, because this is quite informative. But I wonder whether, as to how many African companies, African companies are going to be benefiting from this huge infrastructure build programs. Not just happening in South Africa. South Africa is talking about 30 billion. You have Nigeria speaking about billions. You have Mozambique speaking about other billions too, and so forth and so forth. Are these projects benefiting Africans? And how many percentage of that of the implementation of those projects have benefited Africans through procurement, through other means, even utilizing local resources, processing them, and so forth. As against, you know, depending on French companies, on other companies that import their own products into South Africa, and perhaps even skills. We want to know how much skills transferred through this particular program has been done. I think those are the very important questions that would like to be answered as the process unfolds. And thank you very much for the briefing, and I think I'm speaking on behalf of members. Thank you for your time, and thank you for really taking your time in explaining the way you explained to us. I guess this then brings us to the end of today's business. We will meet tomorrow at 11. At 9 at committee room 1. Mobo? Here we, in the ruling party, we start working early. Thank you very much, Minister and members, for your attendance. Come again? Oh.